Let's go back to Ecclesiastes 1 and look at that. I've titled this, A Look at Life Without God. In 1960, Mrs. Murray was upset that her 12-year-old son was having to recite the Lord's Prayer each morning along with, I believe it was about 8 Bible verses, no comments or anything, but in her public school in Baltimore, Maryland, and she was upset about that. And so the school accommodated her and said that your son doesn't have to recite the Lord's Prayer, that your son does not have to be there when the Bible is read, but she was not satisfied, took it to court through a series, and so about 3 years, 2.5 years or so, of court proceedings. Eventually, it was combined with another court lawsuit and brought to the Supreme Court. And so an 8-1 decision in June of 1963 said that public schools could no longer have Bible reading and prayer in their time there when kids are there. It's interesting, her son, William Murray, who Madeline Murray O'Hare supposedly brought the lawsuit against the school system for his sake, the 17 years later, he came to know Christ as a Savior in spite of what she was doing. And one article I read said that he shared this. The true reason that his mother was filing the suit was her deep personal hatred for followers of Christianity. He said her zeal against Christianity was so great that it had taken over her life and rendered her incapable of seeing other people as anything other than either enemies or people who agreed with everything she thought. And so everything became very black and white to her. Either you're my enemy or you're fully with me. She didn't see any in between with that. But the effort to remove God from our public square, from our public discourse, from our society has really not stopped since then. We know that God is always present everywhere. That is part of his sovereign reality. But when a nation makes an official decision to push God out, it is never good. In fact, it is always very troubling. And I think that when there's devastating results, I mean, you could see that in the public school system in 1963 after that decision, and how immorality and trouble and difficulties skyrocketed. It's a very interesting set of stats. You can probably find them on the internet. But some time ago, I saw this on the border around a license plate. It had these words. It says, if you are living as if there is no God, you better be right. And I thought that was a pretty pointed statement there. Psalm 14 says it this way, the fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. So what if God was removed from everything in our public society? What if it was unlawful to discuss Jesus in your workplace? Some of already have that law and have that rule. What if God does not really exist? And really, that is the ultimate conclusion to the theory of evolution. That is the conclusion they come to. There is no God. The first few chapters of Genesis are just fallacy and a fable and myth. And therefore, really, the whole rest of the Bible is really not reliable. If the first part is unreliable, and so is the rest of it, that theory would go on to say, and really, why did Christ come to this earth? Why did he come? He said, I came to seek and to save that which was lost. I came here to die upon a cross and rise again to save humanity from their sin. But if you take out the first few chapters of Genesis, then none of that makes sense. Because that's where man fell into sin. That's where the reality of sin and death all comes into play. If no thing like that, then Christian teachings are the ideas of men, and there's no difference between Christianity or Buddhism or something else, just a philosophy of life. If there is no God, then the morals and ethics based upon God and his written word are not to be followed or not to be put or elevated in any way, shape, or form. Now, I don't think the majority, at least some stats I've read and some surveys that I've seen, that the majority of people in America and really around the world do not deny the existence of God. But I think many people live as if God was not involved in this life, that God somehow did not notice the things that are going on. And many people just pick and choose what they want from the Bible or the Quran or whatever it wants to be, and I'll just pick and choose it. As I've said before, it's Seattleosophy, the philosophy of Seattle area, is that you pick and choose whatever religion fits you, and so you don't feel uncomfortable with anything that you want to follow, and that's what it is. But let me just say, when I'm preaching from the pulpit here, that God is true, that God is real. that Christ is a reality. Christ died on a cross and rose again. He truly did that. The Bible is true, and we can believe any part of that, every part of it. And so when you throw out God and you throw out his truth, then really the meaning of human existence really changes. It's put on its head, and it's just flipped upside down. If we don't connect life with the reality of God, there's a whole lot of mental, emotional, spiritual issues that come up that may still come up, but they wouldn't come up in the same proportions they come up today. And so the book of Ecclesiastes is interesting because it follows, it tells us what it would be like if we tossed God out, if we didn't connect him with life, if we didn't include him in what we do and where we go. And so notice as we read in this, as was read a little bit earlier, notice the last three words of verse 3 and the last three words of verse 9. They are the same. It says, under the sun, and that's found 27 times in the book. And it's so what Ecclesiastes does, it says, let's look at life under the sun. Let's look at this earthly life and what it would be like, and let's see what it's like if we take God out of the picture. If we just live life as if God did not exist, or live life as if we ignored what he wants us to do. And so part of the, and really what Ecclesiastes does, it doesn't ignore God. It just says, let's look at this. Here is how it would work itself out. But you need to recognize that God's involved in life. And so it often says stuff about fearing God and following God and recognizing him. And so there is a right philosophy of human existence that this gives to us. And we're not going to go, obviously, into the whole book. But he does, as I say, present it. Okay, what would it be like? And really, I think Ecclesiastes, in a sense, is an Old Testament gospel tract. He says, okay, let's try this in life. Let's try this in life. Let's try this in life. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. And we'll see that as we go through as this introduction, verses 1 through 11, set up an introduction for the whole of the book. And so I ask, the question is something like this. What can you observe and conclude about human existence if you ignore the reality of God? So let me say that again. It says, what can you observe and conclude about human existence if you ignore the reality of God? And so chapter 1 sort of gives an introduction. So we'll just look at two conclusions or considerations about life if you ignore God's existence. And that's what he's getting at, just sort of setting it up as it goes through, and he'll prove it through the rest of the book. But starting in verse number 2, I'm going to call it the first of all verses 2 and 3, the conclusions from an honest evaluation of life. So remember, he's looking at life under the sun. So in a sense, he said, let's just, for the sake of illustration, let's exclude God for a moment. Let's look at what life is like under the sun, like life is on this earth. And so he gives an overall analysis, and then he gives a question. So verse number 2 is that overall analysis and utter frustration. Verse number 2, he says, vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Now he uses that word vanity 30 times through this book. And what he does, he's going to say, hey, let's look at wealth. And see where it takes us. Let's look at pleasure and see where it takes us. Let's look at having power and see where it takes us. Let's look at having relationships and see where it takes us. And so he does that all through this book, and he comes to this conclusion. He says, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. In fact, go over to chapter 12 a moment and just look at verse number 8 near the conclusion of the book. Because as he gets all done and goes through various illustrations and so forth, he comes to this conclusion in verse 8. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, all is vanity. And so he begins and ends the book. He said, that's the theme. So what does it mean if something is, what does the word vanity mean? Now in English, there's two aspects to that, okay? The first one that we see is in this English is someone who's absorbed in themselves. Often pride and arrogance. That's not the thought here, okay? The thought here is more on the idea of emptiness, futility, frustration. The Hebrew word for the Hebrew basis or root of this word vanity means breath or vapor. It's just here for a very, very short time. But it also has the aspect of something that's unsubstantial, something that's not reliable, something evaporates. There's nothing permanent or fulfilling. So under the sun, what Solomon will go through, he'll say, you know, you look at things that seem so promising and then they fail. You look at things that are supposed to satisfy, and then when you get into them, they're disappointments. You look at things that often take up most of your time, and sometimes they're very pointless. You look at things that are supposed to bring pleasure, and they frustrate, and they bring sorrow. So Solomon begins this. He says, vanity of vanities. And the idea there is this is utter vanity, and he states that twice. And then he begins, it comes to the end of it. He says, all is vanity. So it's not just surface. It's really down to the very foundation. He said, every part is somehow of life under the sun, of life on the earth. If God was not, if we don't involve God in it, somehow it's just empty. It doesn't amount to a whole lot. So he says, let's take a careful and let's take an honest look at these things, because it's disappointing. It's frustrating. That doesn't mean there's no enjoyment. That doesn't mean, you know, I forgot where it's at now. Hebrews talks about there's pleasure in sin for a season, for a time. I don't think he's really talking about sinful things, though he does mention those things here. He's just talking about existence. It's almost like, I don't know if my wife will smile if I share this or not, but I'll share it. She's smiling at least right now. You ever had a food that, you know, maybe you've had it many, many times, and then you get ready, and you're ready, and you taste it, and it's not quite right. And so I look at my wife, and I say, what, is it something you did different? And her countenance falls and said, why? Why do you ask that? Well, I said, it tastes a little different. And then she could usually explain, maybe she was out of something or, you know, so forth. Or she was trying something new and, you know, surprised me. I didn't know it was going to be new. My taste buds would have been prepared beforehand. But anyway, yeah. So yeah, there's something there you're tasting. And you know, man, there's just something not quite right, but you can't put your finger on it. That's what he's talking about, vanity. There's something like just not fulfilling. It's just not meeting a need. It's just not, but you don't know what it is. You can't really put your finger on it. And as you go through Ecclesiastes and really the rest of the Bible, God has put a hole in human heart. Really, God didn't put it there. The fall of man put it there. And God says the only way to fill that is with me. And if you don't fill it with me as I've revealed myself in the Scripture, it'll always be like there's something missing. I personally believe that some of this is not, I mean, some of these things, you know, I've jumped out of an airplane and so forth, so some of these things are just exciting. But sometimes when I think a present generation has, as you exclude God, you got to get something more dynamic, more thrilling, more to find something that'll fill the heart. But you never really find it. So as it says here, the longing within that human heart can only be filled by a faith response to God. Outside of that, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. It's just filled with frustration and emptiness. So that's the first thing, the overall analysis and utter frustration. The second thing, the ultimate question that he mentions here, what gain do you have in the end? Verse 3, what profit hath a man of all his labor, of everything he does, which he taketh, and here's our phrase, under the sun? What gain is there in all the toils and all the troubles you go through? When it's all done, when it's all completed, what is there in the end? You put in all this time and the energy, and it just seems like it comes up not quite as full as you thought it would be. And God says, I want you to think. And as I said, Solomon will go through the whole book with observations and experimentations. Very interesting. One of them, he talks about pleasure, and he talks about alcohol. And there was a very interesting illustration of someone over in Britain who purposely, to find out what it was like, she binge drank for a number of months to see what it did. She was very conscious of what she was doing, and that's really what Solomon talks about. It's a very interesting outcome that she had health issues, she had some other issues, and lost relationships, all because she was trying this experiment. That's what Solomon does through here about a number of things. So he talks about, hey, you may gain fame, but what do you get in the end? You may find some places of power and position, but what do you get in the end? You may find some wealth, but what happens in the end? The goal may be gained, and Proverbs does talk about a goal that's gained. There's a sense of satisfaction. You know, if you were hoping to maybe run a mile in so much time, and you start off and you're 2 minutes behind that, eventually as you continue to exercise, you eventually hit that. And man, you made the goal, yahoo! But how long does that last? Oh, I got to go faster. You know, you may have a goal for finances. Hey, I met that goal. Now what? Well, I want to get more. So there's always something a little bit beyond that. And the frustrations, again, are to remind you need God. There's something more to life than just things under the sun. All we know right now in Seattle is it's hot under the sun. But God says there's more he's talking about here. And Jesus asked another question. I'm just going to throw in here because it reminds me of it. Jesus said this in Mark chapter 8, verse 36. He said, "What shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul?" That's sort of another going beyond life under the sun, going into eternity. And he says, hey, you can gain everything there is to gain in this world. You can gain all that there is to be found. You can get the power and the fame and the fortune and all that thing and find all the pleasure you can. But he says, what's going to happen when you die? That's more than just the end of it on earth, at the end of it in eternity. And so I hope that you know Christ is your Savior. See, Jesus said, I've come to, you might have life and you might have it abundantly. And so in the sense of, I've come to give you eternal life so that one day when you die, you'll go to heaven. But I've also give you abundant life. And I think that's a satisfied life. The sense of you can even in this life, though the fall of man and the curse of man and the vanity of it all, he said, yeah, you can find fulfillment in me. So those are the conclusions of an honest evaluation of life. Just sort of summarize in verse 1, 2, and 3. And then in verses 4 through 11, I'm going to call it the components of an honest evaluation of life. If a person say, you know, I want to make a difference in life. I want to do something that will change the course of history. And that's noble, and that's good, and that's a wonderful ambition. But two things under the sun that can frustrate that. And so there's a message from nature that he mentions here, and he personifies nature and talks about it. And then there's a message about just the human heart. And so two things here that we look at. So the message from nature, of course, God is in charge of nature. It's not Mother Nature, it's Father God. And he is in charge of all of it. And he, in this fallen world, he's still in charge. But he says, I want to use nature as an illustration here that Solomon does under the inspiration of God's Spirit to illustrate the frustration and the vanity of life. And so those are in verses 4 through 8. And so the contrast first. And the contrast is, please follow, I'm just following what it says here because it's very interesting. Verse 1, one generation passeth away and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever. And I put it this, the contrast, your life is very minimal. When you leave God out, how important is your life really? Nature says it's not much. One generation comes and another generation goes. And sometimes those don't even meet each other. Let's just say for one generation is just born. And Eliana was just recently came into this world. And if we had someone who was an older generation and they just pass away from this world. Well, this generation was not old enough to know this generation. May know it through pictures, may know it through what other people say. But honestly, there's no personal relationship between the generation that just was born and the generation that just passes away. And there's maybe two generations between that. But the fact is, one comes, one goes. But then he says, the earth abideth forever. Now, he's not, we know the earth will one day be burned up. But what he's taking, he says, let's get the big scheme of things, where we fit in. Of 7.5 billion, how many do you know? How many know you? Probably not very many. They say that you have close friends, it's probably a handful. Acquaintances are more. But the fact is, on the big picture, in the radar screen of all of humanity, we're not even a blip on the radar. We're not even a pixel in the big picture of things. Some people are remembered better than others. I remember a number of years ago when Bill Clinton was president, that I asked a teenage girl, I said, do you know who our president is? She said, no. Now, today, politics is a little more out there in the news, but I thought that was interesting. So even those that are most in the events and the happenings of the world, still sometimes they're not even known. And even if you make a difference, sometimes you're forgotten, you're ignored. People just don't know what you've done. And so I think it's very interesting that, life is not that big a thing, and just from one generation to the next, it's all forgotten. I had a friend of mine who was a state senator in Montana, and he said one of the biggest frustrations he had there was we would go in and we'd be able to pass a piece of legislature that was good, it was moral, it was decent, there were some things in that, and this was probably 25 years ago, I guess, maybe even longer than that. But anyway, he said, and the frustration is when the next election cycle comes in, there's new people that get into the state senator, they can dissolve everything you've done. And it's all gone. And he said, man, that was frustrating. So he said, not only does one generation forget what the next, what the new generation forgets the past generation, but even less than that, just a couple years. So if we consider what happens under the sun and we leave out God's thoughts, God's directions, you realize we come, we go, and when we're gone, we're forgotten. It's just the way life is. Aren't you glad when God says he loved the world, he loved all the individuals within the world? I was sharing with my Sunday school class, I just learned today, I thought it was very interesting, that a rainbow, that when you see a rainbow, if you ever, sometimes look it up, but a rainbow from the air is a complete circle. Okay, it's just how the light refracts over it, and if you're above it and you can see it, it's a complete circle. I saw one, I didn't even know that, and one time I was on an airplane and there was clouds below and there was a circle, and I said, wow, and it had all the colors of the rainbow, and I was saying, oh, that's a rainbow, but it's a rain ring. And so that was really neat. But they said that whenever you see the rainbow, because the way light refracts, that you are always in the center of that circle. So if someone was over here a couple miles and over here and they both saw the way the light was shining and it was refracting and it was coming to you, I would be in the very center of that half circle. I'd be right in the center. But the person who's 2 miles away, they would also be in the center because it comes through how you see that light. And I always thought, man, that is cool. So when God looks down from heaven and he sees this rainbow in this circle, if you're down below it, he sees you at the dead center. Or at least I see him at the dead center of the circle. Maybe that's the way I should see it. But God just loves us as individuals. If you let evolution follow its course, you know what we are? We are nothing. We're just a little speck that comes, goes, it's gone. Who cares? I'm glad God cares. And so your life is not worth much in that perspective if you see it from just under the sun. But if you see what's above the sun and know Christ, it makes a difference. So that's the first one. A contrast. Your life is very minimal. The second thing, a comparison, your life involves monotonous toil. I'm sure we've all seen the hamster running in his little exercise circle. He goes, and when he gets off, he steps off right where he got on. That's like life. We step on, we get it moving, and once we get off, it's about at the same place. And so he says, he takes up nature here and he says, let's look at how nature works, how the creation works. And really, let's think of that sort of personified. So verse number five, he begins with the sun and he says, sun illustrates strenuous toil. He said, the sun also ariseth and the sun goeth down. And the next word is very, and hasteth to his place where he arose. So he personifies the sun and he says, you know what? The sun comes up. And he's going, he goes over, and he comes, and he goes down, and he sets on the other side. And then the idea, when he sets on the other side, the picture is he hastes. He's got to run all the way back over here so he can start the whole thing all over again the next day. Now, we know that's not how it does, but he's just personifying the sun. Let's just think about it this way. He gets up, and he's got to haste. And he's just toiling, and he's exhausting himself. In fact, the word hasteth, the Hebrew term has the idea of out of breath. It's exhausting. You ever feel like that? You get up, you go to work, you come home, you eat, you go to bed. My daughter right now is taking some, she graduated, but she's taking some more classes right now. So she goes to work and she comes back and she goes to classes, she eats and she goes to bed. She gets up and, I mean, there's a few more things in life that she's doing to keep it there, but it's just, you know, we've all done that. Our life just gets monotonous and wears us out. And that's what he says the sun illustrates that. And then the second illustration is the wind. And I call it unexpected toil. He says, the wind goeth toward the south, and it turneth toward the north, and it whirleth on continually, and the wind returneth again according to his circuits. Now, if you've studied anything about winds and so forth, that you probably know that, you know, if you look at the globe, there's certain ways the wind moves this way and that way, and that's why flights take certain courses so they can get the certain winds to go from one place to another and all that kind of stuff. So God has set it up that there are certain ways the winds go here and this place they go here and, you know, another equator they go this way and so forth. But within that basic direction of how the wind moves, there's infinite variety. Wind doesn't necessarily blow at the same time every day in the same way, in the same direction. Now, there are certain ways that our weather comes from the ocean and moves east, but how that moves about, it changes all the time. And I think that's what he's saying, that life has its twists and it turns, and you never can plan for everything. There are many unexpected things that happen. You may have car insurance and you may have seatbelts on and you have your airbags and all that kind of stuff, but no one is ready for a car accident. Oh, yahoo, I got in a wreck today. Man, it was so exciting. I got to meet some new people. I got to talk to the police department. I got to talk to the patrolman. In fact, my car was such a wreck that it blew up and there was flames there. We had the firemen come in. It was so exciting. I'm so glad I got in a wreck today. You don't do that. You don't want to. And what happens whenever those unexpected things come, what does it add to your life? Work. Oh, I got to call the insurance. I got to buy a new car. I was talking to someone just the other day, and they were, and this person had been a car dealer previously, and they said, "Oh, I got to go get another car. Pray for me." I thought you liked cars. I do, but not that much. And so, life is unexpected. Has that unexpected toil. The wind illustrates that for us. And then he said, "The rivers illustrate incomplete toil." Interesting. I love this. All the scenarios here that God used Solomon to write, and it says that. In fact, it was interesting in his day. As you read the narrative there, in 1 Kings and maybe 2 Kings. Yeah, I think it's 1 Kings and Chronicles. It says that people came from all over the world, and you understand they didn't have encyclopedias and the internet and all that kind of stuff. People came all over the world to ask Solomon about things. And it does imply, there's a couple statements where it seems to say that they even asked him about nature. Hey, how does this work? How does this function? And so Solomon was not ignorant of things. God had given him wisdom above all the people that were alive that day, and he understood a lot of things about nature. So he was not just spouting off. He said, "I observe these things." So verse number 7, "All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. It doesn't overflow. And unto the place from whence the rivers came, thither they return again." In other words, they keep coming down from the mountains, and they keep coming down, they keep coming down. And he's talking about hydrological? I wasn't sure if I was saying that right. So what happens is the rivers all flow out in the sea. They don't get full, obviously, because out in the oceans and in the sea, that the moisture is evaporated up into the clouds. The clouds come back over the land. The clouds drop down the rain and the snow often in the mountains, and it's up there until later on. Then in the springtime and the summertime, it begins to thaw, and the rivers flow down. They go back out to the sea, and it goes up, and it comes back, and so it just keeps going around in a circle. Now, he's not talking necessarily about that, though he is implying that. But he said, the rivers just keep running and running and running and running and running and running and never stop, and they never change. It just keeps happening. Never make much progress. It's like when you finish one project, you got another one. How many have a honey-do list, guys, men that are married? Okay. If you don't, I'm not sure what's happening with you. But and what happens when you finish the one project? Oh, yeah. Honey, did you know the sink is leaking over? Oh, I didn't know that. Okay. Oh, do you know, something else broke? Oh, okay. Give one thing, we have to do something else. And so it seems like you could put the sea of unfinished tasks is never complete. You just got to do more and more and more. So again, he's illustrating us all this monotonous toil is illustrated by the sun and by the wind and by the rain, or the rivers, I guess you should say. And then he gives this application in verse number 8 about from this monotonous toil. It says all things are full of labor; it just wears you out. God says, you know what? Trying to figure it out just adds to the frustration, because he says you can never explain it all. The first phrase after that, he says, man cannot utter it. In other words, you can talk about it, but you can't figure it all out. And here was the wisest man at that time. And he says, I can't figure it all out myself. And so you may go, you ever gone to the expert, and maybe on the internet, supposedly an expert, and you read something about it, and you say, oh, that seems to answer that question. And then you look at another expert, and all of a sudden he's contradicting the first expert, supposedly. And then you get three or four. You know, if you ever have medical issues, you know what? Often you start reading all sorts of things. You used to go to the library and get all these books out and trying to figure out, okay, what's going on? What does this mean? How does this work? But now you just go to the internet and you get all this information and you got any more information than you ever need, but you never figure it all out. Because this doctor says this and this doctor says this and they don't seem to agree together. And so he begins, he says, you never explain it all. And then you can never observe it all. The eye is not satisfied with seeing. There's aspects of that can mean several things, but I'm just going to take it along the same line. You never observe enough in a lifetime to answer every question. And then he says, you never learn it all, nor is the ear filled with hearing. You go to the seminar, you read a book, you watch the video, but you know what? You could still not figure out all the mysteries and difficulties of life. So verses 4 down through verse number 8, God says, you know, without God in the picture, the message of nature is it just keeps going on and on and on and on and never is fully complete. You can't explain it all. You can't understand it all. You can't learn it all. That's how life is with under the sun. So without, I would say this, and this is just like the guy yesterday. He wouldn't allow me to even talk to him. But without the revelation of God to answer some of our, not just our basic questions of life, but our personal questions about how to live, you're not going to know it all. It'll just be vanity and futility. And even when you have the answer, sometimes you feel that frustration. So that's the first, the message from nature, and then the manner of humanity in verses 9 through 11. He says, you want to make a difference, but you need to recognize a couple things here. Humanity does not change through the years. Verse 9 through 10. And the thing that hath been is that which shall be. So the experiences of man is the same. It's universal for every age and every place. Now remember, when it says there is nothing new, in fact, let me finish reading that, and he says, and that which is done is that which shall be done, and there is no new thing under the sun. And then verse 10 says, if there is there anything whereof it may be said, this is new. It hath all been already of old time, which was before us. Now, he's not talking about, you know, technical innovation. He's not talking about, you know, a new iPhone or a new, you know, Galaxy, I don't even know where it's at, 10 or whatever, I'm not sure. But he's not talking about that kind of technology. He's not talking about medical discovery. He's not talking about those kind of things. He's talking about how people live and how people relate and how people go about their business. So he says the experience of humanity, it's the same. No one in the 1800s ever had a computer program that froze. Last night, my wife was copying something off, and I'd given to her, and so she was trying to copy it to our computer. And all of a sudden, she was trying to get on our computer, on a laptop, and she said, the password, did you change the password? I said, no. She said, well, I've tried it. And she said, you restart it? Yes, restarted it. You know, you do all those things. And then it got on, so I went over there, and I put in the same password, and it didn't work. So I put it in again, and it didn't work. Put it in again, and it didn't work. And so finally, I said, I don't know, honey. I just can't do it. And I was doing something else. So I had to get back to it. And so she's fiddling around with something. She said, I got it. And I don't even know what she did, but she got it, so it started running. Well, anyway, during that time, we were trying to print something off. So before, I guess it was after that, she was trying to print something off, and it wasn't going to our printer. So we printed it out, you know, we tried it several times and finally went over there and finally I said, no, forget it. Let me just send it to the home computer and we'll print it off from there. So I finally did it and I printed it all off. And so then it was like 20 minutes later. And all of a sudden, we tried to print it about 8 times. And all of a sudden the printer comes on and starts kicking out. I said, what is this? And I said, oh no. And so I put delete. And then it stopped, and then it started again. So I put it, and I had to do that for about 15 minutes because I couldn't get on, and she'd turned off the computer, and I wasn't going to, it was a long story. And I'm thinking, man, what is a mess? So people in the 1800s never had to do that, you know, but there were things of inventions in the 1800s, they didn't always work. And it's the same frustration. We just have it in a different setting and scenario, but it's just the same frustration. Here's something new. This will make your life easier. Right. All those time-saving things that you get, and then you got to figure out how to use them, and it wastes all the time that you supposedly are saving. You know, people in the 1700s didn't have to bother with freeway traffic jams in Seattle, but they had things that tried their patience as well. And so, folks, that's the concept he's trying to bring across, is the frustrations of life. You know, it's different, but it's the same. There's nothing new. And the actions of humanity are the same as well. It says that which is done is that which is done is that which shall be done. People are people. And from generation to generation, people react and respond in very similar ways. The fallen nature of humanity and its reaction to life is no different. You know, you can go to, if you went to the African bush and you were there just say for the sake of illustration, some kind of straw hut and mud hut or something, and that's where you lived. You know, you'd have the same problems with the people who lived in that mud hut that you do in your brick and mortar house in the States, because people are the same. And that's what he's trying to get across. There's nothing new under the sun. And, you know, in fact, it's interesting. In our whole scenario with our present-day culture, we try to figure out new labels on old problems. And that's what psychology does. A lot of that stuff. You know, there was something I was ordering from Amazon not too long ago, and they changed the box, and I had to double-check to make sure it was the same thing. And it was. You put new labels on a box, change the box, still the same stuff inside. And that's the same with humanity. We may dress differently. We may speak different language. But what's on the inside of humanity is still the same. It doesn't change. And psychology tries to put new labels on old problems so that they can try new ways to solve old problems. But God still has the answer a long time ago. And he says you just need to apply it to the hearts of people. God still doesn't have an answer. Just like this man yesterday, he said to Ben, all these counselors, he said, no one can answer my question. God does have an answer. And God always will have an answer. And so there's nothing new under the sun. And the last thing in verses 10 through 11, the latter part of verse 10 and down through verse 11. Individuals do not learn from past years. He goes on to say at the end of verse 10, is there anything new? And then he says, it hath been already of old time, which was before us. You know, there's a lot of things you say, well, this is brand new. This is different. And, you know, the problem is we're not omniscient in the sense of knowing all that happened in the past. And he goes on to say this in verse number 11, there is no remembrance of former things. We just don't know it. And as I mentioned that quote, the only thing we learn from history is that men don't learn from history. It's just how it is. You know what the problem is? Sometimes we don't even learn from our own history. We have something that happens when we're in our 20s, and then when we're 30s, we repeat the same problem. We respond to people in the same. It was like a young man over in Wenatchee, and he said, Pastor, can I talk to you a moment? He says, you know, everywhere I go, there's people, and they do this and they do that. And so what he was talking about, he worked at a fast food, and I think I've shared this before. He worked, and I don't remember the exact order, but it was like he worked at Wendy's for a while, and he worked at McDonald's, and he worked at, I don't know, say Taco Bell or something like that. And he gave the same scenario. The same thing happened. I said, let me ask you a question. Who was at all of these places that gave you all this trouble? He said, I don't think there was anybody. I said, think real hard. I said, who worked at all of these places when you were there? Well, I did. Ah. And he, all of a sudden his countenance fell. And he said, are you saying it's my problem? I said, yeah. I said, let's talk about that. I said, we can't deal with all your coworkers, but I can help you. And he didn't like that very much. But anyway, the thing, we didn't even learn from our own history. So the generation, as he says there, the generation, there's no remembrance of former things, neither shall there be any remembrance of things that are to come with those that shall come after. We forget the past, and the future will forget the present. He said, this generation will not take note from what's happening today, and what we don't, we're not taking note from what happened in the past. He said, that's human nature, because the only thing that really has an impact upon us is what happens to us right now and what happens to me, because we're basically self-centered. We basically only care about what's happening right now to us. What will happen to me? And folks, you make a difference in someone's lives today, and you need to for Christ's sake, okay? But what I'm saying in this scenario that we're talking about, life under the sun without putting God into the scheme of things, people are going to forget what you did. I've said this before, and I've seen this happen a number of times. People are a blessing to another person for 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 years. An incident takes place, very small incident, and what we would say, boy, that's pretty minuscule. But all of a sudden it becomes a major issue, and all of a sudden they forget the 30 years of blessing this individual gave them because of one incident, and they say, we're parting ways. You're no longer my friend. That's amazing, because you forget it all. We forget so quickly. So an honest evaluation based on nature and human nature and the creation nature is life is a frustration, and all my toil under the sun amounts to not much. So notice, let's go back to the end of the book, because that's where I want to turn there. We'll close. We'll turn two places and then we'll close. So Solomon at the very end, as we saw in verse 8, he mentions again, vanity of vanities, all is vanity, saith the preacher. But then verse number 13. Let us hear the conclusion. And as I said, he goes through there and he mentions a number of things and says, hey, look at this, it's a vanity. This is vanity too, and this is vanity. This emptiness, it's frustration. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Number one, fear God. Now, fear God, remember, that's not being, oh, no, God. That's not the idea. The idea of fear God is saying, okay, what is God like? I want to recognize him properly, and that's he's revealed to us in the Word. I want to recognize what he's like. He's great, and he's grand, and he loves me, and he cares for me, but he's righteousness, and he's holy, and he's true, and he's honest, and he's pointed, but he's compassionate. All those things are true. What is God like? I recognize for him for what he has revealed to me in the Word. And number two, if you're going to have the fear of God, then you got to respond to him properly. If he is holy, therefore I ought to avoid sin. That's a proper response to his holiness. But he loves me, therefore I need to come close to him and accept what he's offering to me in salvation. So the fear of God is a proper recognition or proper response to God that gains or maintains a right relationship with him. That is to fear God. And so he says, in other words, respond to my son and the offer I have for you through his death and his resurrection so you can be transformed by the grace of God. As I said earlier, Jesus said, I've come to give them life and to give them life abundantly. Give them eternal life and give them a life to its fullest. That's what I want to provide. And the second thing he says there, and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. Keeping his commandments is not how we get saved. But when I am saved, then I say, Lord, what do you want me to do? How do you want me to live? And he says, here's what I want you to do. Here's how I want you to speak. Here's how I want you to conduct your life. That's his commandments. Therefore, I will obey them. Not because it's going to save me, but because I am saved. I have a relationship with God, and therefore I want to find out how to please him, how to honor him, how to thank him. And I do that with my life and how I respond. So I keep his commandments. He said, that's the whole of man. That's what it's all about. So I want to add one more thought. Go over to Matthew chapter 11. Matthew chapter 11. Because when you feel the weight of life's frustrations, and I would say this not only to someone who may be here without Christ, maybe you do not know Christ as your Savior, and you feel the weight of life and the futility and the frustrations of how a life under the sun is. But I'd also say it to those who may know Christ already, because we can get caught up in the cares of this world and we miss what God wants us to do, the cares of this world, the frustrations, the anxieties. So Matthew chapter 11, right there at the end, verse 28 through 30. Jesus said, come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden. There's lots more to that, but just we could apply it in the thought of today. You that are frustrated and feel empty, come unto me and I'll give you rest. I'll fulfill you so that you can have a calm about your spirit and you can know me. He said, then he says, once you do that, then take my yoke upon you. Learn of me. That's that, oh, keep his commandments. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly of heart. Get to know me. Not just my expectations for your life. Get to know me. Build that personal relationship, and you shall find rest into your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. I got a plan and purpose. You can have usefulness. You can find purpose and meaning for your life, even in the present, through Christ. So I'll close with that. Life under the sun can be frustrating. Life under the sun can be difficult. But it's part of really what happened when God said, because you've sinned, Adam and Eve, then the curse is going to fall on, and that's part of life. And like I would like to have told that man yesterday, you know, sin devastates so much. And God allows it to run its course so that we might see that we need God. And maybe this morning you're facing some of those frustrations. And God's trying to say, would you break? Not God doesn't want to tear you apart, but use your spirit to be broken a little bit so you come to me. Trust me. And maybe some of God's people need to do the same. Say, God, I'm listening. I'm listening. Let's pray. Father, thank you for today and for the reminder of life's frustrations. And really, it's part of the curse of sin. We know that. And yet, Father, you've given us an answer to that. As it's phrased here in Ecclesiastes, to fear you and keep your commandments. Or as Jesus said, to love me and keep my commandments. To follow you because we love you. Lord, may that be a testimony of our hearts.